This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I've got a lot to cover. We've got five movies, which includes Keanu, Mother's Day, Ratchet & Clank, Green Room, and Sing Street. I'm also going to talk about some news, the trailer park, there's some listener feedback, and an interview with Pink Boy on Tarmac from Time Chasers, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@themovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Couple pieces of news. The first one is actually something that happened last week, and that is the fact that Prince, the musician, died unexpectedly. They just found him unresponsive in his elevator at Paisley Park. Now, the reason this is significant is because it causes a lot of people, you know, he was young, he was 57, which is pretty young to just suddenly die unexpectedly like that. You know, I mean, if he was like 89, that's not a terrible surprise. But yeah, and he was still touring, he was still doing stuff, he was still making music. Now, part of the thing that dovetails into movies is because it does have this significance of Prince being such a force in movies in the 80s. Of course, in 1984... he made Purple Rain, which was kind of this rarity when you look back of this film that has him as basically playing kind of a version of himself. But the reason it's significant is because, you know, not since stuff like Elvis or the Beatles had you had these people playing themselves in movies that had such a high profile. You get that a lot where they cast a musician essentially playing a musician. They did that last year with the movie called Song One or something like that with Anne Hathaway and this independent musician. But this was important because Purple Rain was a huge, huge album and a huge movie. I never saw it actually until just recently. I watched it after he passed away. It was because in 1984, I was 13, and it was bad enough I bought the soundtrack, which had the Darling Nikki song on it. So my mom wasn't about to let me go see Purple Rain. But also significant to movies is 5 years later, he did Batman. And the reason Batman is so important is because it was the last full involvement of a musician into the soundtrack of a movie. Shortly after Batman, they just kind of had soundtracks come out of music inspired by, or the music would be just playing on the radio in the background or over the end credits. In Batman, they integrated full-blown Prince songs into the movie. I don't think it works terribly well, and I took a lot of umbrage with it when I was a teenager watching it, but that was a big deal back then. Now, of course, they're bringing back Purple Rain to the theaters, which is kind of interesting because you can get it on demand for $3, but they're also having The Revolution, who is Prince's old band. They're touring to honor him. And I don't know if they're honoring Prince as much as honoring the fact that they're just getting gigs now, because no one before Prince died, no one just wanted to hear The Revolution. It'd be like Morris Day and The Time. The Time doesn't run around and say, hey, we're The Time. Hey, where's Morris Day? We don't have Morris Day. It's just The Time right now. So rest in peace, Prince. It's sad when somebody who is that active goes. And this, we've had some significant deaths this year already with, you know, like David Bowie, for example, another musician who had a great impact on cinema. Another little piece of news that I thought was notable is Lionsgate has come out and said it's going to start offering some of its biggest films through a streaming platform via Steam, which is a gaming platform. And the reason that's significant, just another place to stream movies isn't a big deal. But the reason that's significant is because Steam is basically a computer, a laptop, or a tablet platform. It's really not something that you've integrated into smart TVs. And that means I think they're going for the youth market. I mean, they're not just putting up their crappy library. They're putting stuff like The Hunger Games up. And that's a big deal. Now, the reason that's bad is because it is now, even though it's a significantly different platform, it's another outlet. Netflix or Amazon Prime isn't expensive. What's expensive is to get Netflix and Amazon Prime and Hulu and now Steam. Then before you know it, you're going to be paying $80 a month just to get all the platforms for the streaming purposes. At some point, I figure that the next generation of this business model is going to be a service that can get everything. Because that's what people want. People don't want something that keeps pulling stuff off of their service. That's getting annoying. And all that does right now is foster more torrents and downloads and piracy. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Since I've got so much thrown in the back of the show, I'm going to hit a listener question up front really quickly. This comes from our good friend, Thomas from Seattle.
I've talked to you about Harrison Ford before. You know, I was a big fan growing up, and I've been kind of disappointed the last 15 years with his movies that he's made. But I was wondering if you think that maybe he showed a little bit more enthusiasm in The Force Awakens and maybe he was back in the game a little bit more. And also, what do you think about a future Blade Runner sequel that I guess they're doing right now and the next Indiana Jones movie? Is that a nice way to end his career? Yeah, I'd like him to go out on a high note. He was a big favorite of mine when I was a kid. And it's like, yeah, I'd like to see him redeem himself. So is a Harrison Ford redemption underway or not?
Yeah, I think Harrison Ford is getting a bit of a resurgence. It's sort of at the end of his career. A lot of times this happens. He's basically doing the Leonard Nimoy thing, where Leonard Nimoy was running away from the name of Spock. He even published a book called I'm Not Spock. And he tried to have a career in the 70s and even in the 80s without being associated with Star Trek. And it was very difficult for him because he was so defining in that role. Harrison Ford, I think, is facing the same thing. He's so remembered as Han Solo and Indiana Jones that he's having a hard time going past that. Well, now that he's in his 70s, he's at the end of his career, and I think he's coming to terms with it. So he's in the I Am Spock, where you had Leonard Nimoy then embrace his role as Spock. So I think you're getting that with Harrison Ford, and I think that's why he seemed a little more into The Force Awakens. Now this Indiana Jones 5. Now, look, I even liked Indiana Jones 4. I'm not somebody who dumps on that movie. The problem is, this is going to be too much of an obvious swan song for Ford. Who does not think that Indiana Jones is going to get killed in this movie? He is totally going to get killed. Otherwise, what's the point of putting this old guy in the movie? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Couple quick ones. The first one I want to talk about is Cell. This is based on the Stephen King novel. It comes out July 8th in limited release.
It's terrorists, right? It's gotta be terrorists.
Don't use your cell phone.
If we're gonna survive, just people are gonna die.
You okay?
They act for the good of the group as a whole. They may be the next stage in human evolution. What's happening now is more than temporary anarchy. It's the start of a war.
My biggest worry about this is it's just going to turn into just another zombie movie. It's just going to be The Walking Dead with a Stephen King twist to it. And that's not what Cell was. Cell predated the zombie craze. Cell was published, 10 or 15 years ago? And it's not a bad little book. And it does more than just have mindless zombies. And that's what intrigued me about the movie, whereas the trailer seems to be just going for zombie apocalypse. I hope that they delve into the interesting stuff of the book, the neo-zombie levels, rather than just the good old-fashioned Walking Dead Romero zombies. The next one I want to talk about is Snowden, opens on September 16th.
The deputy director of the NSA offered me a new position.
How is this all possible?
Think of it as a Google search, except instead of searching only what people make public, we're also looking at everything they don't. Emails, chats, SMS, whatever.
Yeah, but which people? There's something going on inside the government that's really wrong, and I can't ignore it. I just want to get this data to the world.
The biggest problem I have with this is Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He's doing yet another goofy voice. I don't think he's that good of an actor. That's the problem. He's trying to be Daniel Day-Lewis or Mandy Patinkin or Gary Oldman, somebody who can become different characters with different voices and different expressions, and he just does not come across well. Plus, this does feel, even just in the trailer, it feels a little goofy Oliver Stone. So I don't know how well that's going to work out. I'm skeptical of Snowden, but we'll see in September. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Mother's Day and Ratchet and Clank.
Only want to see you laughing in the purple rain.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
The elevator tries to break you down. Go crazy. Punch a higher floor.
Kevin Carr with the movie reviews from Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's dive right in. Let's start off with Ratchet and Clank. Based on the video game series, this animated film tells the heroes' origin story as they try to save their planet from a galactic evil.
Our galaxy is in a state of crisis.
Captain Quark?
The Galactic Rangers are looking for a new recruit. We want you!
Yeah!
If you have heart, then you have what it takes. You don't have what it takes.
Wait!
Next!
My name's Ratchet. I'll just call you Clank.
In 2 days' time, the Galactic Rangers will be destroyed.
An attack is coming. I must warn the Rangers.
I can totally help.
I remember hearing about this movie a couple months ago, and I've just heard the name. I know it's a game out there, but what's funny is my kids are sort of into gaming. We don't have any big gaming system, but my two youngest children watch a lot of YouTube videos, so they know about a lot of the games that are out there. And this seems like it would be really geared towards my youngest, who's 7. He's really into, like, Skylanders. And he also does Minecraft and Mario Kart. I mean, he's into the little kids' games, and that seems to be what Ratchet and Clank is. He's never mentioned it. And I've heard people tell me that it's a good game. And maybe it is. But there is a long, sordid history of Hollywood making video game movies that suck. And I don't think they changed their stride at all with this film. This movie is directed by Kevin Monroe, whose most recent attempt at a big movie was Strange Magic. That was that Lucasfilm movie that came out a couple years ago, and it was CGI, and it like took place with these little fairies in the earth and everything. And it had this weird musical soundtrack. It was terrible. And this movie feels exactly like that. You can really see the influence of Strange Magic to this film, because it has the same throwaway lines and overly winking and nodding at the audience, and it's really not funny. It's also extremely boring. I mean, it looks kind of cool. I mean, the it's CGI, and I mean, we're 2016. You throw enough money at a movie, you're going to get good special effects, and you're going to get good spaceships and interstellar vortexes and all that cool stuff that makes the movie look good. The other thing that has this weird connection to Strange Magic is the Lucasfilm connection. Even though this isn't a Lucasfilm movie, Strange Magic was. It was one of George Lucas's pet projects when he sold Lucasfilm. And Ratchet and Clank doesn't steal from Strange Magic as much as it does just steal from Star Wars. There's literally shots in here that are right out of Star Wars. There's a couple shots in there that look like they're almost lifted completely from the pod racing scene in Episode 1. Also, if you look at the story, the general story of the movie itself, Ratchet is this orphan living on a desert planet in the middle of nowhere, and there's a galactic evil out there blowing up planets with a special new device, and Ratchet finds a robot that crashes on his planet and then uses that as a launching pad to go join an interstellar military of some sort. If that's not the same template as Star Wars, I don't know what is. So, I mean, it's completely derivative of Star Wars and not very well written anyways. But overall, it's just a boring movie. I mean, it's only like an hour and a half, but I dozed off. I apologize. I fell asleep probably about 6 or 7 times in this movie because it just got so repetitive and stupid and I mean, they go to the Star Wars thing where they go to the station and have to try and shut it down and then come back home and then go back again for a final assault to get rid of it before it blows up their home world. I mean, this film is just such a mess of a movie. And it's so derivative, but it really just has no appeal to anything outside of somebody who's really into the game or just somebody who wants to see a stupid animated film. So I'm going to have to say Ratchet and Clank sucks.
It sucks.
Next up on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Mother's Day. Gary Marshall directs this light family comedy with multiple storylines about motherhood.
Hello, Atlanta. Happy Mother's Day.
I'm here for a job.
Tell me more about this tween and your ex-husband.
I'm sure I exaggerated. I'll have a better idea once all the acne clears up.
It's just all this Mother's Day stuff, and I start thinking about how I haven't talked to Mom.
Hi.
Oh, I have to say, Jess,
you haven't aged that much.
Thank you.
I was adopted. I've always wondered, did she just throw me away?
What you have to do, you have to find your mother.
This is the third in a string of films that Gary Marshall has done. He did Valentine's Day back in 2010, and that was a big hit. Had a huge cast, and it had multiple storylines, all taking place on Valentine's Day and kind of intertwining, and it worked for the gimmick that it was. And then the next year, he did New Year's Eve, which did not do nearly as well. And I think part of it was because it was kind of like that one-shot gimmick, and to try and just replicate it onto New Year's Eve. And New Year's Eve isn't the rally-around holiday that Valentine's Day is. Valentine's Day is about love. You can make a movie, a romance, but New Year's Eve is about drinking and puking. And it just didn't click as well. It did okay, but it wasn't a huge movie. And so then we had this 5-year hiatus, and now they're doing Mother's Day, which I'm sure the Mother's Day you can rally around, but there's so much wrong with this. First of all, this shouldn't be called Mother's Day. This should be called White Mother's Day, because there are no black people in this movie. It takes place in Atlanta, but there are no black people. There's like one, like in the first half hour, there's a sassy woman at a gym, and there's a bellhop in a hotel who walks by the camera. That is it on the racial diversity of Atlanta in this movie. The people are also every single cliche you can think of. There's the unmarried young couple with a kid. There's the divorced couple whose ex-husband has married a young, hot woman. There's the woman who is a career woman who has a secret, which is a daughter that she gave up for adoption. There's a storyline where these two sisters have basically disappeared from their parents' lives and just only talk to them on Skype. One happens to be a lesbian, and the other one happens to be married to an Indian. That's the most diverse they ever get, by the way. That is the most racially diverse they get with the main cast. It's very ham-fistedly written. It's full of cliches. It throws everything it possibly can at you. Not just the cliches of the setup of the story, but you have the cliches of stuff that happens and how they resolve a story. I mean, I'm not going to spoil anything for you if you really want to go out and see this movie, but you can see where they just really seem to rush this script. Maybe it's because Gary Marshall's like 112 years old and they're just afraid he was going to die before he could get this movie made. But they really crammed it all together. And like Jennifer Aniston's character, the only way she could be more annoying is if she were played by Jennifer Lopez. She's just an awful person that you don't want to spend any time with. And it just doesn't hold together. And it has like 15 different endings to it because they have all these storylines they're trying to wrap up. And on top of it, they've got these somewhat has-been actors. I mean, Julia Roberts was big in her day, but not really now. And Kate Hudson, has she even been in a movie lately? Jennifer Aniston really isn't drawn. I mean, she's hit or miss. Jason Sudeikis is also on the poster. Yeah, he plays the stay-at-home dad because his wife's dead. But, you know, they couldn't be divorced. I mean, it just doesn't work organically as a film. I mean, if you love the other two movies this guy did, I guess it'll be fine. But this has more in line with something like What to Expect When You're Expecting, that sort of multi-storyline movie, than a little bit more of a charming Gary Marshall film. Ultimately, Mother's Day sucks as well.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to talk about Keanu and Green Room.
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Continuing with the movie reviews, let's talk about Keanu. After his girlfriend breaks up with him, a man bonds with a stray kitten, only to have it kidnapped, causing him to enter the world of gangsters to go find him.
Why is your door open?
Keanu.
Keanu! I'm sorry.
Oh, what's up, bro?
I'm here because my place got broken into. Has anyone shady come by here?
I mean, the 17th Street Blips.
The 17th Street Blips. Okay, where are they?
17th Street.
Every day I'm hustling. Every day I'm hustling.
Cheddar's got Keanu.
We in the market right now for like a gangster pet.
You serious?
This is spearheaded and stars Key and Peele. They had a series on Comedy Central, which is a sketch comedy show. They're very innovative. They're very fresh. They're very hip. You know, these two black guys that could do a lot of stuff that, you know, like a white comedian can't do on Comedy Central. And they kind of blew up on Comedy Central, sort of like between Dave Chappelle and Amy Schumer was the Key and Peele time. Now they've been showing up in other movies. They've shown up on, you know, you've seen Peele in movies like Wanderlust, and you've seen Key in movies like he was in Horrible Bosses 2, and he showed up in Parks Recreation, and they do a lot of bit parts here and there, but they're strongest and most well known for their comedy together. So they got a chance to get to do this comedy together, and it has some very funny moments. In a way, it feels like a long form Key and Peele sketch rather than a modern comedy film. And in that sense, it feels like a comedy film that would have been made in the 80s. You know, like something starring Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, something like Silver Streak or Stir Crazy, where it's a comedy, but it also follows a logical plot line. It's not just this random assortment of gags and goofs. You know, like if you saw Vacation last year, that one just turned into a random assortment of jokes and gags that didn't quite hold together as a film. This one is a story, and it's an absurd story because it's all about this kitten, which is an adorable kitten, by the way. And it has some very funny moments. It has some very raw moments. It has some very shocking moments. It's definitely R-rated, so you don't want to bring the little kids to this film. But it's not like a wall-to-wall laugh-out-loud movie. And also, if you've seen the trailer, you do get a lot of the really great zingers in there. There's still some funny stuff in there outside of the trailer, but the real jokes with punch to them, those tend to be taking place in the trailer. So you may have gotten some of the best moments spoiled, but still, there's a lot of stuff in there that's funny, and it works as a story. It's not as funny as I expected it to be, especially knowing the reputation of these guys. So go in knowing that, but it's such an absurd movie. I think it's one of those movies that if I watch again, I'll appreciate it more, because there's like classic comedies I've seen or movies that I remember being very funny. Great example is Groundhog Day. I recently rewatched Groundhog Day, showed it to my kids. And you think of Groundhog Day as this nonstop laugh riot, or even the original Ghostbusters. Any of these movies with the classic 80s comedians in them. Blues Brothers is another great example of that, where you remember it as being a long form funny movie. It really isn't. Those movies have great moments and great scenes, and they do take diversions to have some funny times, but they're more or less telling an absurd story with a funny cast. And that's essentially what Keanu is doing. Not all the jokes land, and some of the jokes do go too far. And not too far in the fence. I'm not saying I'm offended, but some of them, they made the joke and they just kept hammering away. So, it's a good first effort for these guys. And I'd love to see them do another movie. It definitely is out of the box and cool and different. And you're never going to see anything like this in any other comedy film. I'm going to say, though, that Keanu is still a kind of rocks.
He kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Green Room. A punk band stumbles onto a crime backstage at a neo-Nazi club and find themselves becoming the hunted.
All right. I can get you guys a solid gig. Matinee tomorrow. Doors at 1. You guys are on at 3.
Gentlemen.
You're trash. Things have gone south. It won't end well.
You can't keep us here, man. You gotta let us go.
We're not keeping you. You're just staying.
Shoot who's left. Let him bleed.
This is presented like a horror movie. I don't know whether I call it a horror movie, because in terms of the setup, it's essentially a crime drama is really what it is. I mean, you wouldn't call a police procedural as a horror movie, but it plays like a horror movie. Kind of like how Silence of the Lambs is in essence a police procedural, but it really works as a horror movie as well. And part of it has a serial killer who eats people. That kind of helps. But that's the way this one is. It doesn't have monsters. It doesn't have vampires, no werewolves, zombies, or mummies, or anything like that. It is these people trapped in a room because they find us in this club, and then they get trapped in the green room. That's why it's called the green room. And then the neo-Nazis have to figure out what to do with them because, you know, they witness something. And so it is that horror movie where they're being stalked by the monsters, which are the neo-Nazis who are trying to get rid of them. And it's a locked room escape movie is really what it is. And it's very tense. It's very gritty. It's extremely grisly as well. It's very violent. It's, you know, Keanu has a lot of violence to it, but it's absurd, over the top, silly violence. There's blood and people get shot, but in Keanu, it's ridiculous in that sense. And it's meant to shock you. This movie, the violence that happens in Green Room is extremely realistic, not just in what happens to the human body when the violence happens, but also what would possibly happen in a situation like this. And in that sense, it makes it like a horror movie. I mean, in a way, it feels a lot like a slasher movie, because there are these kids that are trying to survive psycho killers, but the psycho killers have a purpose. And they're just not out there killing for willy-nilly sake. I mean, they're not Jason Voorhees hacking up the counselors at camp because they're having sex. They're trying to stop anyone from snitching on them, really, about what happened. It's shot very grim and dark. Of course, a good chunk of it takes place in this punk club, this neo-Nazi punk club, where it's very dark and the walls are painted black and there's just really dim fluorescent lighting. And that plays into it as a horror movie. Now, one of the best parts about the film is the main bad guy is Patrick Stewart, who does an incredible job. And the reason he does is because he's very, very evil, but he's also Patrick Stewart. And we have become so conditioned to just adore Patrick Stewart. He's like our dad. And you just want to give him a hug. It's Jean-Luc Picard. He can be a little bit stiff, but, you know, it's Jean-Luc Picard. It's Professor X. He's the guy to respect and look up to. It's like Morgan Freeman. He played God. But Patrick Stewart's character is an evil SOB. And it reminds me, I remember saying this to another critic who was at the screening with me. I asked it, have you ever seen the movie Way, Way Back? And that's the movie that came out a couple years ago about the kid who goes to Florida with his family. Steve Carell played his would-be stepfather in that movie, his mom's boyfriend. And the character's a real jerk. The character's a real a-hole in that movie. But it's Steve Carell, and we're so conditioned to like Steve Carell, he's able to be that a-hole and us not immediately react to it. And it was very real because he has that charm, but he's a really not a nice guy. And that's the way Patrick Stewart is. Way worse than the character from The Way, Way Back. But Patrick Stewart's character, he is a nasty, murderous, evil SOB. But he's presented with Patrick Stewart. And it sends this dissonance in our brain where we don't know exactly how to fit that together. And that works to the movie. So, you know, Green Room was a big surprise of how much I enjoyed it. It's definitely worth checking out, especially if you like horror movies and thrillers. Green Room rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be giving a review of Sing Street, have a little bit of an interview, do the box office, and, of course, the home cinema roundup.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's do our final movie to review, and that is Sing Street. A Dublin teen in the 1980s starts a band to get a girl and finds a way to come into his own against bullies and the overbearing administration.
You'll be new then. What's your name?
Connor Lawler.
Shut up!
Who knows what this new prison will do for you? This is your time.
You see, it's beautiful.
How come you're not in school?
I'm a model.
Cool.
Do you want to be in a video for my band?
We need to form a band.
Rock and roll is a risk. You risk being ridiculed.
Now, I was really skeptical of this movie going in. And the reason I was skeptical of this movie going in is because I am not a fan of John Carney, who directed it. Most notably, he did Once, which I absolutely hated. Not only did I not like it, not only did I think it was undeserving of the accolades and the awards it got, and the charming, oh, isn't this wonderful, these little musicians walking on the street, I personally just hated the movie. I was bored with it. I was annoyed with the characters and the actors, and it annoyed me during the award season of, what, 2007 or something like that, when that came out, that it was getting so many accolades. So when I heard Sing Street was coming out, I was like, oh, I don't know. Another musical drama by John Carney. Is it going to be as bad as Once? And like I said, I know I'm in the minority on that one. And begrudgingly went to go see it, and I ended up just loving the heck out of this movie. It really captured it. And I think part of it is because it was less of this fantasy biopic of this guy trying to be a street musician, which was Once. It actually tells a charming little story, and there's a lot of reality to this. And by setting it in Dublin, makes it relatable, because we all went through high school and we all know the crap that you deal with in high school, but you can remove yourself from it because it takes place in a different country, unless, of course, you're from Dublin. The bullying that goes on doesn't seem as harrowing, because there's so much bullying in American movies, and it's laid on so thick. And I remember the 80s, and I don't remember bullying being like this in America, but maybe it was in Dublin. I don't know. But it's a way you can look at this fake world through this veneer of the film and get into it. And then the other thing is the kids, they're great performances and very charming. And you got this band that this kid sets up just to get this girl, and the girl is pretty, but she's not snobby enough, but she's also not damaged enough for you to just get really annoyed with her. You know, she's not so damaged. Like, what was that movie? Paper Towns. Paper Towns was the annoying version of this kind of movie, where you had this wimpy kid who is obsessed with this girl and goes to the ends of the earth for her. Whereas this one, it seems very real. And the kid also has some cojones on him. This kid is not just this wimp who's getting bullied. He's coming into his own, and it's a great coming of age movie. And it features some fantastic music and some fantastic performances. Again, it strikes at my heart because I grew up in the 80s and I love this sort of thing. I was stunned at how much I like this movie. I will say, if you go watch this movie, go take somebody to like a double feature and watch half of it, and then, you know, maybe sneak them out of the theater and then bring them in at the end of like Green Room. And you can look at these as two parts of the same movie that go really horribly wrong. Anyways, jokes aside, Sing Street, great movie, totally rocks.
It rocks. Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Got a little bit of a treat here. I've got an interview I want to play with Peter Harrington. Now, most people don't know who he is. He is an actor who was in the 1994 film Time Chasers, which was famously lampooned on Mystery Science Theater and is coming to theaters live next week, May 5th at 8 o'clock. And they're going to be broadcasting from Nashville, where they're going to have the Riff Tracks guys riffing it live. And they're going to bring the cast and crew in from Time Chasers, which includes Peter, who played Pink Boy on Tarmac, who was the guy in the ice cream suit, and he's got the mustache. So I had a little chance to talk to him to preview the event for Time Chasers Live coming up in Nashville and on Fathom events around the country on May 5th next week. I have to admit, it's been a while since I've seen Time Chasers. And
okay.
I just want to make sure you played the guy in the ice cream suit, right?
Yeah, Matthew Paul. I am Pink Boy, yes.
What did you first think when it first showed up on Mystery Science Theater? What were your initial thoughts?
I was delighted. Anything that would get the film in front of the public just kind of makes it a cult item. We had a get together and we all had a good time watching it on screen, and that's where I picked up on Pink Boy, and I've been Pink Boy ever since.
Because I know that sometimes you put your heart and soul into something and it stings a little bit if some people are making fun of it. There's a classic story from Mitchell. That was another movie that was made by MST. And
yeah, that, I saw that, as a matter of fact.
Joe Don Baker.
Evidently, he wasn't happy, huh?
No one had a Joe Don Baker response when this first came out in the late 90s?
Actually, I had heard from online sources, just through email and some other places, that there was a story going around that I was extremely upset and disappointed and angry at what they had done to us. And I don't know who got a hold of that or whatever gave them that idea, because frankly, I had a great time with it. I thought it was pretty much good, clean fun, no below the belt hits that I could really take issue with. And I think if you talk to David, he will tell you that I was one of the ones that was laughing the hardest at the whole thing.
Now, what do you think? It's almost 20 years since the MST version. What do you think now, with it getting kind of revived again through a Riff Tracks presentation?
Again, the same as when it came out with MST3K, I'm delighted that they think enough of us to even use us. It has, again, energized the interest in the film at large. I had no problem with it. I'm looking forward to it. The one thing that I have learned and come to a decision about is that if you cannot stand up and take a pie in the face for what you've done, then you have no business being in a business that's in the public eye.
Have you heard any of the new riffs? I mean, obviously they're not using the same script, but are you aware of anything they're doing, or are they keeping that under wraps and are you going to get it unleashed on you?
No, I don't know what David knows, but to me, they haven't released anything yet, and most of it will come as a surprise. Having been an avid MST3K fan in the past and knowing how quick-witted and rapier-like they can be, I expect there'll be a couple of moments of, ooh, but that's what they're there for.
Well, you can always blame it on the 90s, right?
Yeah, exactly.
How many other people are going to be there at the live show? You're in Nashville, right?
Yeah, it's five of us. It's David and Matt Brew, Bonnie Pritchard, George Ward, and myself, the director and the four principals.
If you want to go check out Time Chasers live with Riff Tracks, you can go to rifftracks.com and buy tickets. Again, May 5th. I think it starts at 8 p.m. at least locally here. Obviously, it's live, so it's going to be at different times, but 8 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, to hear the full interview with Peter, you can go to Fat Guys at the Movies and check out the full interview there. Now, let's talk about the box office. Last weekend, not a big surprise, Jungle Book 1 beat the pants off of The Huntsman. Jungle Book made over $61 million. The Huntsman couldn't even make 20, which is a huge drop from its predecessor, the Snow White and the Huntsman. And I think that pretty much kills this franchise. It also proves that Chris Hemsworth still can't open a movie if he's not swinging Thor's hammer. But The Jungle Book is going great guns. It's cracked $200 million going into this weekend with huge numbers. And again, is the one to beat. And then some smaller, I mean, Elvis and Nixon made it, what, the top 20? It didn't even make $500,000. This week, I think it's going to be Jungle Book again, because I don't think Keanu's going to muster enough people to go see it being R-rated, and it's a smaller group, not terribly well-known name recognition-wise. And Green Room, as good as it is, isn't going to get to a wide audience. And then, of course, Ratchet and Clank's for a niche audience. And then Mother's Day, I think, that boat sailed 5 years ago with Valentine's Day. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Krampus, which is odd. I don't know why they're releasing this in April. They should have waited and dropped it around Christmas, because Krampus is a Christmas movie. It's an anti-Christmas movie. And it's very good. It's Michael Dougherty. Now, it's PG-13, and it's not as R-rated as I would have liked it to be, especially for a movie that you really don't want to take kids to. But I had a heck of a good time watching this movie. It was a fun Christmas horror movie. Now, there's also Ride Along 2, which came out earlier this year, like in January. Ice Cube, Kevin Hart. I actually kind of liked this one. I thought it was fun. I actually liked it a little bit better than the first one. I thought it was a little more cohesive. There's also Son of Saul, which got a lot of good award buzz. It's a depressing tale about a man who is trying to make good for his son, who's dead, as he's working in a concentration camp during the Holocaust. There's also Jane Got a Gun, which came and went and was shot dead by audiences. That's it for this show. Thank you for sticking around. And next week, when I come back, I'm going to be talking about the big movie to kick off the summer season, and that is Captain America: Civil War. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.